the dramatic events in the Arab world represent a fundamental turning point in the whole situation, not just in North Africa and the Middle East. It represents a fundamental turn in history. And the first point is that it's not an isolated thing, but it is a manifestation of the global crisis of capitalism, which is beginning to crack at its weakest point, at its weakest link. And the first point is this is a real inspiration, not just for ourselves, but it's an inspiration for millions of people on a world scale. It's a complete answer to all those wretched, miserable skeptics and cynics and cowards and renegades who sneer at the working class and sneer at the masses. They moan about the alleged low consciousness of the masses. And all they can see, to use a crude expression, all they can see is the arse of history. That's all they're obsessed about, is the arse of history. Trotsky said that it's one of the features of reformism is a slavish worship of the established fact. Adoración servil de los hechos establecidos. The facts, look at the facts. Yes, look at the facts. Look at the facts in Tunisia. Tunisia was supposed to, not supposed to be, it was the most stable Arab country. No signs of anything, apparently. If you look at the surface, if you look at the surface of things, like an empiricist looks at the surface and is incapable of seeing the deeper processes that are taking place. I have some quite amusing quotes, which I can't resist from giving, but I'll give those in a minute, which show the complete perplexity of all the bourgeois, strategists, experts, economists, politicians, university lecturers, you name it. You know how Trotsky defined theory? You know how Trotsky defined theory? The superiority of foresight over astonishment. Bourgeois is always astonished when a revolution takes place. Seems to go against all the norms, normal behavior, normal conduct, normal politics, normal life is interrupted. They see it as a kind of collective madness. Society suddenly goes mad. Don't understand the contradictions that are underneath the surface. The apparent stability is only apparent. And this superficial bourgeois psychology, this superficial method of empiricism based on the facts, give us the look at the facts, is contradicted by history. Dialectics shows that things turn into their opposite. That's why we have to look at the deeper processes taking place. The Arabs were supposed to be backward, ignorant people. I got some nice quotes to that effect. The Egyptians in particular were said to be, it was in their character, you see, passive, they would accept anything, they would put up with anything, apathetic, and apparently that was the case. But they said exactly the same about the Russian people before 1917. Exactly the same. The Russian peasant was supposed to put up with patience, he'd put up with anything, put up with tyranny and so on. From a scientific point of view, it's a false method. And in this particular case, it contains an element of overt racism, of racial prejudice, feelings of racial superiority. And by the way, that brings me to another point. You get so-called Marxists, these pseudo-Marxists, and there are too many of them, who moaning and groaning about the low level of consciousness. But they're affected by this poisonous mood in society because there's been a little bit of a delay in the movement of the working class in Europe. And they begin to clutch their heads, they begin to sob into their green tea. Oh, there's a low, look at the low level, look at the defeats, look at the low level. I answer, look at Egypt. Look at Tunisia. It's an absolute vindication of everything that we've said. And it seemed to come like a bolt from a clear blue sky. False. False. This tendency predicted these movements. It's in black and white. But I will deal with that in a moment. What a marvelous inspiration. Looking at the events in Egypt in particular, you can only compare it to one thing. One comparison comes to mind anyway. The marvelous movement of the proletariat of Barcelona in July 1936. No party, no leadership, no program, no pre-established plan. Although Trotsky explains in the Russian Revolution that the masses have never got a preconceived plan at the beginning of the revolution. They never know where they're going. Where are they going to get the pre-established plan from? From Allah, perhaps? There's no plan. The masses learn through struggle. But it's, as in 1936, with no party, no leadership, they marched on the barracks in 36, I'm talking, in 36, with sticks and stones and knives and old hunting rifles. And they smashed the reaction, they smashed the fascists. They saved the revolutionists. That's the real working class in all countries. And you see this in the marvelous movement in the Arab world. I know some comments say, well, it's not correct to say the Arab Revolution. And they've got a point, because there are people there who are not Arabs, of course. The Berbers are not Arabs in Algeria, and they've got a specific problem. You've got the Kurds, the Armenians. By the way, there's an insurrection now in Kurdish Iraq. All of the Druzes, there are many people who are not Arabs, that's true. But I can't find any other way to describe it. You can't say it's the North African Revolution because Egypt is not in North Africa. You can't say the Middle Eastern Revolution because Tunisia is not in the Middle East. I suppose you could say the Arab-speaking countries, but then not all of them speak Arabic. So, but it's not a serious problem, I think. And of course, Iran is not part of the Arab world, it's true. Yes, but you had the Spanish Revolution, we refer to it as the Spanish Revolution, and there were Catalans, and there were Basques, and there were Galicians with their specific problems. You still say Spanish Revolution. And the Russian Revolution, what are you going to say about Russia? You had the Armenians, and the Georgians, and the Ukrainians, and the Lithuanians, and the Uzbeks. You're going to put all that in a title? The Iberian Revolution's okay, but there's no equivalent for the Arab world. That's the trouble. It wasn't Ted Grant, it was myself, if you want to know. That's another matter.
It's signed by Ted Grant.
I know it is, but I wrote it. But when we speak about the Russian Revolution, we know what we're talking about. And I never heard any Ukrainian or Georgian Marxist complain about the term Russian Revolution. Now, it started in Tunisia. And we weren't looking at Tunisia, because it's a small country and so on. But we did say, years ago, not now, years ago, it's in the perspective documents, that Egypt, Jordan and Saudi Arabia are hanging by a thread and can be overthrown at any time. We emphasized that during the Gaza War. And there was a very good article written by Comrade Hamid and Frederick, I think, two comrades from Denmark. In October, which pointed out that revolution was imminent in Egypt. Now let me just, I can't resist from quoting this. The Economist on the 6th of January. Tunisia's troubles are unlikely to unseat the 74-year-old president, or even to jolt his model of autocracy. That's the 6th of January. A few weeks later, he was overthrown. On the 17th of January, the BBC's Cairo correspondent, his name is John Lane, I think, said there's no sign that Egypt will take the Tunisian road. He said if Tunisia is to be the first of a series of dominoes, the first of many Arab autocracies to collapse, there is no sign yet, this is the 17th of January, there's no sign yet of the contagion spreading to Egypt. Sitting in the bar drinking gin and tonic, he couldn't see what was under his nose. He's in Cairo, of course. We're in London, but he's in Cairo. Can't happen in Egypt because Egypt is not Tunisia. Well, we know that Egypt is not Tunisia. There are no pyramids in Tunisia. Yes, but there are no pyramids. But the same problems exist of high unemployment, rising prices, falling living standards. corruption and a dictatorial regime. And as a general law, you can say general rule, similar conditions tend to produce similar results. That's true even in the evolution, by the way.
Yes.
And why does this BBC correspondent insist that they're not the same? I quote, "Unlike Tunisia, the population has a much lower level of education. In other words, they're ignorant and stupid. They have a low level of consciousness, my friends. Illiteracy is high, and therefore they're unable to read the reports of the BBC. And internet penetration is low. So how can there be a revolution in it? You see the complete stupidity of the so-called strategists, the so-called experts. On the 25th of January, the day when the revolution started, when the masses were on the streets in Egypt, Hillary Clinton said, and I quote, with apologies to John, "Our assessment is that the Egyptian government is stable and is looking for ways to respond to the legitimate needs and interests of the Egyptian people." Yes, I know. He's my model. You see, the complete ignorance of all the strategists of capital. Can't be a revolution in Tunis first. Can't be a revolution in Egypt second. Can't be a domino's effect third. And as for the effects in other countries, well, they don't even talk about it. Now, we, on the contrary, predicted this, and we should say so. And I don't think it's an accident that most of the other left groups were left with their mouths open. They were unable to react. By the way, not only the left groups, because they're spreading this lie about the Islamist, Al-Qaeda and so on, Muslim Brotherhood. The fact is that the comment Mr. Hamid was telling me, that jihadi groups on all their blogs, I don't know what a blog is, but it must be something. All the jihadi groups were paralyzed by this. They didn't know how to react. And neither the Muslim Brotherhood or any of the Islamic groups had anything to do with these movements. And that is a fundamental change in the whole situation. Now, we predicted the situation in Egypt, but we didn't mention Tunisia because, frankly, we weren't paying attention to Tunisia. It's a small country. But the same problems exist. In all these countries, the same problems exist, particularly of youth unemployment. Even in Syria, and there's been the beginnings of a movement in Syria, the Syrian regime actually was a deformed worker state, that's been cancelled out. Now they've gone the other way. All of these, the privatizing and so on. Even in Tunisia, I think there was a big state sector, I think I'm right, to Jordi, under what's his name? Bourguiba, who called himself a socialist. Pardon? Yes, Fred says it was 80% state-owned in Tunisia. In Egypt also, it was mainly state-owned under Nasser. And Gaddafi the same in Libya. But they've all gone the same way. For the last 20 or 30 years, they've been moving in the opposite direction. Privatizing, market economy, market reforms. You know, the hypocrisy of the Americans is really something. Now they say, When the whole area is in flames, they suddenly discover the merits of democracy. They supported these regimes for 20 or 30 years. They were silent about their crimes. Somewhere here I got a quote from Sarkozy. If I can find it. I can't find it. Doesn't matter. I remember what he said in 2008, he went to Tunisia and he said, "Your country is making a tremendous contribution to human rights and democracy." Great friend of Ben Ali. And Kahn Strauss, isn't it, the managing director of the IMF?
Strauss-Kahn.
Strauss-Kahn, same difference. Strauss-Kahn. Kahn, Strauss, who cares? Strauss-Kahn. He said, "You see, Tunisia is a model for most emerging countries. Well, for once I agree with Strauss-Kahn. Tunisia is a very good example for these countries, but not in the sense that he meant. Now, in the case of Tunisia, the movement started with an accident, you could say. I use the word accident in a dialectical sense. Hegel says that necessity expresses itself through accident. In this case, a tragic accident where this young man burnt himself to death. And there must have been other cases like that. This time, it was different. The whole thing exploded. All the conditions had matured. And therefore, it was like a powder keg waiting for the fuse. Now, I won't go through the details of the uprising itself, because we dealt with it in Jordi's articles. I'll just make one point, however. All revolutions basically have got the same laws. They go through the same stages. It is amazing how history does repeat itself. History constantly repeats itself. And you see that particularly in revolutions. One of the most astounding things is how even the characters repeat themselves, same characters. Charles I of England, Louis XVI of France, and Nicholas, the Tsar of Russia, they all had a very similar character. And their wives had similar characters. Their wives played a role. And Mubarak is the same type. And his wife is the same, and Ben Ali's wife is the same type, yes. Same type. And they act in the same way. The first reaction of a regime like that is always the same. They use violence. Ben Ali had a big repressive apparatus. Because the usual argument of the reformers is, how can you have a revolution? Look, they got the state, they got the army, they got the police. Yes, that's true. Didn't Louis XVI have an army? Didn't Tsar Nicholas have an army and a police force? And in the moment of truth, all of that was swept to one side. It was marvelous what they did in Tunisia. It's a small country. And the police, in all these regimes, is very brutal. They use torture and they murder people. But the people fought back. They didn't have any guns. But they fought back, and they showed they were not afraid. And once the fear disappears, that's it. So then, of course, Ben Ali resorted to the second tactic. Repression doesn't work, so you try concession. He made several speeches, then three or four on the television, offering concessions. The last concession that he offered was quite amusing. He said, I have ordered the army not to fire on demonstrators. And it's very easy to order something that's already happened. The Tunisian army said, the officer said, no, we can't do this. Not for humanitarian reasons. Because they understood, like the Egyptian high command understood, one bloody incident where the army would fire on unarmed demonstrators, just one, and the army would break in pieces. It would shatter in their hands. They didn't use the army because they could not use the army. On the very same night that he made that speech, what night was that, Jordi? When did Ben Ali flee? I can't remember the date. The 14th of January, was it? Yes, on the night of the 13th of January. That's 1 week after the Economist said that he couldn't be overthrown. His regime wouldn't even be shaken. That's it. Ben Ali was on a plane with his suitcases packed, and they must have been very tightly packed with money, heading for France. See his old pal Sarkozy, his great friend Sarkozy. But of course, when he knocked at the door, nobody likes failure, you see. Nobody likes failure. The servant said, I'm sorry, my master is not at home. Oh, and by the way, you can't land your plane in France. You see, sirs, there's no gratitude in politics. He had to go to Saudi Arabia. And the Saudis greeted him with a red carpet or whatever, or a white carpet, whatever color they used. They're very sympathetic to Ben Ali, because they might be next. Now, once this revolution had taken place, when it was a revolution, good heavens above, what's all this stupid nonsense? Oh, it's not a revolution because of this, and it's not a revolution because of that. Lenin answered that very well in 1915 in a marvelous article that's called the the discussion on self-determination summed up. Resumida. You should read that article, because above all it deals very well with democratic demands. And democratic demands now are fundamental in these countries. People that have been oppressed by a dictatorial regime for decades. You see, it isn't just an economic question. We mustn't be economic determinists. Of course, unemployment and poverty play a big role, especially among the youth. 75% of young people under 30 years of age in Algeria are unemployed. The figure for Egypt is 76%. And you'll find that there's similar figures in all the other countries. And that's an important factor, especially for a layer of university graduates, people who have... And here you see the impasse of capitalism. It's a crime of capitalism. Don't these countries need doctors? Don't they need teachers? Don't they need engineers? You know, but, and yet these people are unemployed graduates. There's no work for them. Also in Syria, by the way. I think that's an important... In Syria, they developed a very high level of education. You commented to that. But there's no work for these graduates. In Egypt, for example, and if an Egyptian graduate cannot get work, you can't get married, you can't have a home, you can't have a life, can't have a future. So these are important factors. Yes, but there's something more than that, something you can't put your finger on exactly, but it is present, a feeling of humiliation. The Arab nation is a great nation. Egypt was a great civilization. And it's been enslaved and oppressed by imperialism for 100 years. More than 100 years. There's a feeling of humiliation. Egypt, for example, being subordinate to American imperialism in the Middle East. Mubarak is a stooge of Israel. Betrayed the Palestinian cause. All of these elements are present. When you refer to nationalism... Well, there's an element of nationalism present, of course. And it's, in this context, it's a progressive thing. There's a burning hatred of imperialism. And there's a burning hatred of the corrupt regimes that were stooges of imperialism. Like Ben Ali, he was a stooge of France and America. I see that the crisis in France you referred to yesterday is partly due to certain people in the government that spent holidays in as guests of Ben Ali. These Arab leaders were bought by imperialism, but they also bought politicians in Europe and America. You better believe it. You see, and therefore the psychological question is important. It's noticeable on the demonstrations. You see, in a revolution, like in a strike, you see the same process in a strike, as a matter of fact. In any strike, people that have been, that were downtrodden and people that would never do anything, apparently, if you look at the facts. But these people suddenly turn into their opposite. People that are in a strike, people that used to be always passive all their life. They develop the mentality of slaves. They suddenly raise themselves up to their true height. And it's not just a question of wage increases and so on. That's not the point. During a strike, ordinary workers feel suddenly that there's something special. They're human beings. I'm a human being. I have rights. I demand my rights. I demand to be treated with respect. And what's true of a strike is a million times true of a revolution. You see this on the television, where they interviewed people on the streets. Not just students and intellectuals, not that. Poor people, illiterate people. No, we're going to fight. We're not going to leave the streets. We demand our rights. We demand to be treated with respect. Now, that's a profoundly progressive thing. Although some of the sects now are saying, it's only a bourgeois nationalist movement. It's not a real revolution. But they don't say what it is. They can't tell what it is. And in this article that I'm referring to of Lenin, I've quoted it, but the comments should read the whole thing. He says... Whoever expects to see a pure social revolution will never live to see one. And he continues. Such a person talks about revolution, And they don't know what a revolution is. And in the same article, he says the socialist revolution, during the First World War this was, will inevitably involve all kinds of uprising, rebellions, and so on, national movements. Lenin understood. And in the same article, he explains the way that revolutionaries must use democratic demands in Egypt, in Tunisia, and in all the other countries. It's an ABC question. A little child of six should understand that. What? A little child of six that had read a bit of Lenin, that is. Trotsky makes this point in The Permanent Revolution. He says that the objective tasks of the Russian Revolution are democratic tasks. The overthrow of the Tsar, a democratic republic, all the other rights, freedom of assembly, freedom to strike, and so on. But of course, these democratic demands must be linked to the class demands, of course. In the Russian Revolution, it was the eight-hour day. And in Tunisia and Egypt, what we would say, must overthrow these regimes, not just Mubarak, that's not enough, but all the little Mubaraks. There must be a complete purge. They must all go. Oh, and by the way, what about the money that they've stolen from the people? You're talking about billions. We don't know how much money Mubarak has stolen. One figure put forward is $80 billion. And therefore, we raise the question straight away. Confiscation of all the wealth of these parasites. Confiscate their wealth. And the imperialists that supported them. That would make sense. And that's already linking the democratic demands to the socialist demands. But on the immediate issue, which is democratic demands, we demand a complete sweep. Iran also. Complete sweep. Barrer todo. The list of the state. Get rid of all these people. We demand complete democracy. The immediate abolition of all reactionary laws. And a constituent assembly. I said, in relation to Bolivia, the slogan of a constituent assembly is a counter-revolutionary slogan. And it was. Why was it a counter-revolutionary slogan? Because at that time, the workers of Bolivia had staged two general strikes, two insurrections, they'd overthrown two governments, and they could and should have taken power. Yes, there were Soviets also, yes. Yes, the Kabildas, I think. The leadership of the COB could have taken power into its own hands. And they failed to do so. Don't take my word for it. Later, about 12 months later, I think, one of the leaders of the Bolivian COB, the trade union leaders, I think his name was Jaime Solares, wasn't it, Jody? He said the following. I couldn't believe my eyes when I read this. He said, the only reason we did not take power is because we didn't have a revolutionary party. Astonishing. And what were you doing, Comrade Solares? They could have taken power and they didn't take power. Now, under those circumstances, to put forward the slogan of a constituent assembly, that's of a bourgeois democracy, when the question on the table was workers' power, was a counter-revolutionary demand. Yes, 1,000 times yes. And you know who was putting forward the slogan of a constituent assembly, as well as the PO? The World Bank. The bourgeois knew what they were doing. And when these wretched bureaucrats failed to take power, they did go ahead with the constituent assembly and they held elections and the whole thing went onto the parliamentary plane. Well, Serge informs you that Solaris has supported Gaddafi. I didn't know that. Publicly. Yes. Oh, and then they compounded the mistake. When the elections took place and Evo Morales stood, they called for a boycott of the election. And of course the workers just ignored them. In El Alto, which was the center of the revolution, 80% voted for Morales. Naturally, the worker, a Bolivian worker is a realistic person. We've made two general strikes, we've made two insurrections. These people don't want, the leaders don't want to take power. So there's elections. I need a job, I need a house. Let's see what Evo Morales will give us. Logical. You see the complete stupidity of all these gentlemen. Now, what has that got to do with the situation in Tunisia and Egypt? It's a completely different situation. These are countries that are emerging from a long period of dictatorship, like Tsarist Russia in that sense. There will inevitably be illusions in democracy, of course. And we don't fly against, we don't go against that. We say, yes, we're for democracy, sure. But it must be a complete democracy. And one of the democratic slogans, it's always been the case, is precisely we need a new constitution, we need a democratic constituent assembly. The question is, who will call it? Who will call it? And we would say, we don't trust Ghannouchi to call this government. We don't trust the Egyptian army to call this. And the struggle must continue on the streets, in the factories, until the whole thing is overthrown. Now, you see, you can't underestimate the profound psychological effects, first of all, of the Tunisian revolution. It was like a huge rock which was thrown into a big lake. By the way, everything I said about democratic demands applies to Iran, of course. And the revolutionists made waves. Immediately there were outbursts in Algeria. Riots and demonstrations. I think it was mainly on the question of food. If I remember correctly, in January, they increased the price of food in Algeria by 20 or 30%. It seems that it's temporarily managed to regain some control in Algeria on the basis of immediately making concessions. I think they've lowered the price of food and given out other things like that. That's not the end of things. It'll come up again in Algeria, where, after all, there was a huge insurrection. When was that? In the Berber area? What?
2001.
Yeah. It was the Berbers were nationally oppressed. But there's going to be outbursts all over Algeria. Now, you could expect that in Algeria because it's next door to Tunisia. Yes, but at the same time, there were big movements in Jordan, which is about 2,500 kilometers away. And we said also that the Jordanian regime, we said, was hanging by a thread. Jordania.
60
minutes. Huge demonstration. There was a repeat performance tour. They were imitating Tunisia. Even some young people burnt themselves to death. Same thing happened in Egypt. But in the case of Jordan, there's a massive movement. And what strikes me about the situation in Jordan, what is interesting, is that the big majority of the population of Jordan are not Jordanians. They're Palestinians. And we'll deal with the effects on Palestine later. One of the many crimes of the OLP leadership, PLO. Was I was thinking of the Spanish, PLO. Spanish is OLP. PLO. Was that they did not take power in Jordan in 1970. They could have taken power easily. If they had taken power in Jordan in 1970, the whole history of their area would have been different. But with their petty bourgeois nationalistic nonsense, Arafat said, oh no, we can't attack our Arab brothers, it's their brothers. Only attack the Israelis. That's right. And the King Hussein, wasn't it? King Hussein mobilized the Bedouin tribes and the Pakistan army, yes. But the Bedouins was the base. They attacked the Palestinians and they slaughtered them. Arab brothers, what Arab brothers? They slaughtered them. Yes. They slaughtered 18,000 people. And by the way, they talk about Israel and Israel. Many more Palestinians have been killed by Arabs than by Israelis. The PLO leadership has played a criminal role for the last 40 years. And inevitably, they ended up betraying the cause of the Palestinians. Yes, but that's these events have got a big effect on that question also. I think 80%. I think 80% of Palestinians in Jordan, aren't they, Jordan?
I think 65.
65. The question. It's a big majority anyway.
They don't really know.
Don't know. No, I read 80%. I believe it. And the base of the monarchy was the Bedouins, but these demonstrations were from the Bedouins, most of them. It started with the Bedouins anyway, and there was one very interesting development. I saw it on the BBC television about 2 or 3 weeks ago. They interviewed the vice premier, the vice prime minister of Jordan. And the BBC reported that there was an opposition movement among the officers, there were ex-officers, ex-army officers, who'd written a letter to the king, I think it's Abdullah now, isn't it? Abdullah, is it? Warning him that you must make concessions. The Bedouins say we feel like foreigners in our own land. And when the question was put to the vice prime minister, he says, yes, but there are not many of these officers. There's only about 150 or 200 at most. This is the base of the regime. And therefore, when we say that the Jordan is hanging by a thread, I mean it. The movement rapidly spread from the Bedouin areas to Amman, the capital. Amman is the capital, where they'd be mainly Palestinians, actually. And that movement in Jordan is continuing. Jordan is very high up on the list. But really, the movement is spread all over the Arab world. But it's spread to Morocco, to Sudan, to Syria, to
Yemen,
even Djibouti. Bahrain, we'll deal with Bahrain in a moment.
The Yemen
everywhere. Yemen is very high up on the list of regimes that are due to be overthrown. So, and of course, there's no domino effect, according to the imperialists. But undoubtedly, the key country is Egypt. Egypt always was the key country. Tunisia is just 10 million inhabitants. And it's on the periphery of the Arab world. But Egypt is at the center, at the heart of the Arab world. And it's a country of 82 million people, with a huge proletariat. How many times have we discussed this? Certainly on the IS, we discussed it repeatedly. From the standpoint of the proletariat, if you exclude Nigeria, the two key countries on the African continent is Egypt and South Africa. And now the mighty Egyptian proletariat is moving into action. And I think we should be proud of the fact that this international understood that well in advance. See that on the website. We've dealt with the question of the strike movement. We emphasized the role of the Egyptian proletariat, while other so-called Marxists were running after the Muslim Brotherhood. And let us be clear about this. The Egyptian revolution was prepared by the proletariat, by the workers. Marvelous strike of the textile workers of Mahalla, and many other strikes. Courageous strikes, when strikes were supposed to be illegal. Now, in the same way that as the burning of this young man was the spark that set off the movement in Tunisia, so Tunisia was the spark that ignited the protests in Egypt. And the movement took everybody by surprise. The organizers were taken by surprise. They organized it through Facebook. As the communists know, I'm the world's expert on the subject of Facebook. I've been trying to open a Facebook for myself for the last 2 months without success.
Somebody's done it for you.
No, but apparently I've got one, but I don't know anything about it. I deny all knowledge of that. Obviously, the things like Facebook and Twitter, Facebook and Twitter and mobile phones, they played a big role. You mustn't exaggerate that. The Egyptian regime actually closed down the internet. They closed it down for 5 days. And I think they restricted mobile phones and so on. That didn't stop the revolution. They used a very good method. It's been around quite a long time, like about a million years. It's called human speech. They convoked these demonstrations by word of mouth, by talking to each other. Well, you know, like Facebook, internet is a virtual thing. You have a virtual audience. You build a virtual party. And according to the English Oxford Dictionary, the definition of virtual is almost but not quite. It's nonsense. The Bolsheviks did quite well without Facebook, and they organized a revolution reasonably effectively. And actually, much more, if you're going to talk about technology, much more important than Facebook and Twitter was the role of Al Jazeera. No, not many people have got Facebook in Egypt. But Al Jazeera was the... Everyone's got a television. Every village has got a television. And that goes for Pakistan, Tanvir. Am I right? Even the most backward village, you see a television. And therefore, millions of people could see these developments taking place hour by hour. And there's no question that played a huge role, also in mobilizing people. Now, I'm going to pass on to Egypt, but just to say in relation to Tunisia, the revolution's not finished. It's the revolution in Tunisia is continuing. The departure of Ghannouchi didn't mean to say that they'd succeeded in their aims. The ruling class has got many ways of defeating a revolution, and if they can't beat it by force, they'll try to beat it by other means, by cunning. They installed this gangster Ghannouchi, and immediately the masses understood that they understood what was happening. The Tunisian masses had a very high level of consciousness. And on this question of consciousness, by the way, I'm getting a little bit tired of this miserable, dreary, monotonous whine, this song that they sing. Low level of consciousness. Low level of... But consciousness always lags behind events. And it doesn't slowly change. You think the Russian workers have read the 3 volumes of Capital? I don't think that many of them got past the first chapter. The masses learn from experience, from events, not from books. And in a revolution, they learn very quickly. Trotsky explains that in the history of the Russian Revolution. He refers to the sudden changes in consciousness, Not because the workers are advanced, but precisely because they're backward. Now, Trotsky says that. A revolution is where consciousness comes up to the level of reality. Look at the consciousness of the masses in Tunisia. They realized that there was this maneuver taking place. Strikes, regional general strikes, demonstrations. And they forced one change in the government after another. And that's not finished. They haven't succeeded in controlling the situation in Tunisia. But I'll leave that question to Jordi. In Egypt, the movement of the masses took the organizers by surprise. It took all the political parties by surprise. The Muslim Brotherhood played no role in this. They told their supporters not to participate. One of the leaders admitted on a website that this movement had nothing whatsoever to do with Islamists. And yet, of course, you get all these politicians in the West. Oh, must be careful, must be careful. The Islamists are going to take it. Al-Qaeda will take control. One of the most striking aspects of the situation is that the Islamists have played no role, or very little role. And therefore, the struggle in Egypt, another thing is the speed with which it developed. 18 days, that's all. A regime which apparently was solid, according to Hillary Clinton, was stable, was overthrown in just 18 days. And you could see there that layer after layer were moving into struggle. And what about the imperialists? This, after all, is a key area. It's not just any area of the world. It's a key area for them. They spent 30 or 40 years trying to establish this position. Egypt, in particular, was a key piece in their calculations. It's been swept away before their eyes in 3 weeks. And they were completely paralyzed. Obama made some general observations, you know, one of sand and one of cement. It's quite amusing. No, we can't. No podemos. What can they do? The most powerful and the richest country in the world was paralyzed, was impotent. They couldn't even speak about it. At a certain stage, even Obama understood that Mubarak had better go. Obama wanted Mubarak to go, but Mubarak didn't want to go. So a small detail, as Jordi said, because Mubarak has got his own interests. Mubarak had his own interests. Oh, yes. And he didn't want to go. So Obama was struggling to say something. He had a 30-minute telephone conversation, which they said was very cordial but frank. In other words, they had a blazing row. And Obama made a speech. He says, well, yes, we're in favor of democracy, but there should be reform. And by the way, it should happen now. It should happen now.
It's none of our business.
none of our business is that the Egyptian people must decide. That's strange. He didn't say that about Iraq.
Or Afghanistan.
Or Afghanistan. But now suddenly the Egyptian people must decide. The one thing he could not say is that Mubarak must go. Because if he said that, the Saudi Arabians would be running up the wall. The Jordanians would be running up the wall. Couldn't say it. And therefore he got the worst of all worlds. There's one Egyptian commentator that said on the television, he was asked, what did you think of Obama's speech last night? He said, I didn't understand what he was saying. You can't translate this into Arabic. He thought it was a problem of translation. The trouble is you couldn't understand it in English either. They were paralyzed. And that's the real balance of forces. Right towards the end, when there was a big strike movement, and there was a big strike in Suez, and they were terrified that they were going to close the Suez Canal, they sent some warships to Suez. I said in my article, that's just an empty gesture. Only one American soldier would have to step on Egyptian soil under those circumstances, and the whole thing would have gone up. You would have had a general strike, and they would have closed the Suez Canal. And the American Marines can't open the Suez Canal. They don't know how it works. So therefore, they could not intervene. And that's a very important point, which we have made before. Now, I'd make the same point in relation to Egypt that I made in relation to Tunisia. The tremendous heroism of the masses. The Egyptian police was hated and feared. But they stood their ground. They tried to use the police. They sent the police with water cannons and rubber bullets and tear gas and so on. They didn't use bullets because Mubarak would have told them, look, don't do anything to cause what happened in Tunisia. Just crack a few heads. And in the past, that would have been enough. But you see that something fundamental changed. The masses were not afraid, and they fought back. You saw them clambering on top of the water cannons, you know. And the police fled. They ran. And then you had the occupation of Tahrir Square. Mubarak then sent the army in. Tanks, guns to intimidate the people. Tanks. Like Tiananmen Square, yes, but it wasn't like Tiananmen Square. The people surrounded the tanks and fraternized with the soldiers. Absolutely showing a high level of consciousness. And, of course, the Egyptian army could not be used. Incidentally, again, the truth is always concrete. The Egyptian army is not similar to, not the same as the French army or the Italian army or the British army or the American army. Not the same. The armies of these countries are the products of the colonial revolution. Now, it's true that the upper layers, the generals are corrupt. They're reactionary. They're part of the regime. But the rank and file are conscripts in the case of Egypt. In the case of Egypt. Not in the case of Bahrain or particularly Libya. It's not the same. Not the same. Egyptian army is a conscript. Libya is not a conscript army. That's what I'm saying. The Egyptian army is a conscript army. Workers and peasants. And obviously they'd be on the side of the people. Yes, but also the middle-ranking army officers would be on the side of the people. In the main. There's a long history of this. Even in Spain there's a history of this. Was a time of the pronunciamientos. Some of them were liberal pronunciamientos. But in the case of Egypt and Syria and other countries, the long history for the last 50 or 60 years of left-wing coups, you had Colonel Nasser in Egypt, 52, wasn't it? Or 53, 52. Or Colonel Gaddafi, if it comes to that. Or Colonel Qassim in Iraq. Or Colonel Nimeiri in Sudan. There's a whole series of these things. And Syria in particular, where they actually expropriated the capitalists. So the army is not the same as in the advanced capitalist country. And therefore they could not use the army. So in a final desperate attempt, Mubarak organized all his supporters, and he had some supporters. The state has got a lot of employees, some of whom get privileged positions and so on. There was the police force, it was a big police force. And also there's the scum of society, the lumpens. They opened the jails. They deliberately opened the jails. The police did that. They let out all the scum, the murderers, the rapists, the arsonists, robbers, to cause havoc. The argument being, well, it's me or chaos. You see, you'll have chaos. But the people began to organize, to defend their neighborhoods. They began to arm themselves. They set up committees. And at least you have the embryo here, you have the embryo of Soviet. It's only an embryo. And then they launched this attack on Tahrir Square. Now, really speaking, from the standpoint of revolutionary tactics, it wasn't very intelligent to just to concentrate in the main square all the time. That shows the limitations of the petty bourgeois, the student leaders. Jordi was telling me last week, I don't know where you got the information from, but I believe everything that Jordi says, you see. He's blaming Eric now, you see. Yes, of course. Apparently he's from Al Jazeera. So. Apparently he's from Al Jazeera, who were very well informed that the early on in this uprising, and by the way, in my first article, the title was Uprising in Egypt, not Demonstration. You got to recognize it was an uprising. It was out there. That a group of junior army officers approached the student leaders and offered to support the revolution. And they said, no, 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 we'll only speak to the generals. We only want to speak to the top men. It's a very silly thing to do. If they'd have done that, then it would have been over like that, and the movement would have gone much further. But you see, Marx makes the point that a revolution must go on to the offensive. The words of Danton, you know. L'audace, l'audace, toujours de l'audace. Although I think that's not quite, the quote is not quite correct about it. It's something like that. And, you know, Marx criticized the Paris Commune because they did not march on Versailles. And you see, in Egypt, the situation could have been lost. It could have been lost. I must confess that at one moment I thought it was lost. Mubarak is—he's not very intelligent, but he's got a low animal cunning. He's cunning. Unlike Ben Ali, said, "No, no, no, my friends, I'm staying." Not really. And what he did was two things. He did two things. On the one hand, he went on television. He said, "Look, I'm not going to stand anymore. My son is not going to stand. Just leave me here till September, it's reasonable, you know. Let me retire with dignity. If I go, there'll be chaos, it'll be like Iraq." He said that. Now, this had an effect. What a revolution does, it stirs up society to the depths. And there's all sorts of people involved. At the beginning of the revolution, you always find that. There's the idea of unity, or everyone together. Typical of the first stages of revolution, typical. And some of the people, the more backward layers, some of the middle class, small businessmen, these people that sell goods outside the pyramids, that their business was being spoiled, they thought, well, that's all right, that's okay, that's enough now, finish. We want to get our life back, we want to get our business back, we can't afford to have this. And then, so in a sense, he was offering reforms and concessions with the left hand. And with the right hand, he was preparing the mailed fist. And they organized this attack on Tahrir Square. It was a vicious attack, which they weren't expecting. Because they were a bit naive. The revolution is always naive in its first stages. Because it succeeded in Tunisia. A few demonstrations and he went. But not in Egypt. But they thought it was going to be easy. At the beginning of the revolution, the masses always have that idea, it's going to be easy. They have to learn through experience, it's not easy. And Mubarak helped to educate them. He helped to educate them with bricks and stones and concrete blocks and tear gas. He educated them. They weren't expecting this attack. They weren't prepared for it. And if he would have succeeded in expelling them from the square, it's possible that the whole thing could have gone into a downward spiral. It's possible. But they didn't. They fought back. Although they were outnumbered, they fought back with their bare hands. They threw the stones back at these people. And inch by inch, they pushed them out of the square. And that was a decisive turning point. I think it could have gone either way, actually. Because if they'd have succeeded in driving them out, Then the next stage is to open the shops, open the banks, return to normality. Put the police back on the streets. Yes, and then they'd have started to arrest people. Yes, that was the idea. Yes, but they were defeated. It was a marvelous action. They were defeated. That changed everything. It also it mobilized the revolutionary force. It's a proof of what Marx said. Revolution needs the whip of counter-revolution. They drove them out. And that also changed the psychology of the wavering elements who were horrified by the violence, and it exposed Mubarak that he was a liar. And therefore that led to an even bigger movement on the Friday, Thursday and Friday, bigger movement. And it looked as if the regime was finished. Yes, it looked like that several times. But each time Mubarak said, no, I'm staying. Why did he do this? Well, first of all, he's a bit mad. Gaddafi's completely mad, but he's at least part mad. You know, the British bourgeois politician Lord Acton made a famous statement. Power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Not an accident. You look at the amount of mad Russian czars, mad Roman emperors. Hitler was mad towards the end. Stalin was mad towards the end. It's because they're surrounded with Camarilla. Who say, yes, you're great. You can do everything. You do what you like. You can do anything. And they begin to believe it. They lose contact with reality. What is madness unless it's to lose contact with reality? It's the madness of power. But there was other factors with Mubarak also. The Saudis were constantly pressurizing, don't resign, stay where you are. Because he's next, they're next. And the Israelis also said the same thing. The Israelis were terrified, and they're right to be terrified. And finally, there's his own family clique. I didn't realize that. It's his own family clique. His son Gamal and his wife. You see, the wives come into this. Mustn't forget the ladies. Don't forget the ladies. You know, don't resign. You're great. You can do it. Stay in power. How can I love a man that runs away? You know, this kind of stuff. Like the Tsarina in Russia, the same thing. She had more balls than the Tsar. You know? So he stayed. The Americans were tearing their hair out, but he stayed. They couldn't get... Then he offers to negotiate through Suleiman, the hands of a part of Suleiman, to negotiate. Now, this is a dangerous moment. The leaders of the movement, or part of them at least, entered into the negotiation. Yes, that's right. Instead of seeing that this is a sign of weakness to overthrow the bastard, finish it, they entered into talks, including the Muslim Brotherhood. That showed their real character. And that was a very dangerous moment, actually. It could have been, the whole thing could have been destroyed. And then you had the decisive element, the entry of the proletariat, which was the decisive factor. By the way, there's quite an amusing aspect of this. There's quite a funny aspect of this. There wasn't a general strike, but Egypt was shut down anyway. The banks were closed, the factories were closed, the universities were closed. So in order to create the impression of normality, they opened the banks and the shops and the factories. Probably the Americans advised them to do this. And then they would have left the crowd in Tahrir Square. They wouldn't have touched them. And then they'd have gradually drifted back to work. That's the idea. But it didn't work. On the contrary, how can a worker strike if the factory's closed? So they opened the factories on the Monday or Sunday. The workers went back to the factory, but they didn't do any work. Down tools, mass meeting, strike, demonstrate, sack the manager, sack the trade union chiefs. This is marvelous. Everywhere the same. Mass strikes everywhere. Universities also, the students had mass meetings at the universities. And that determined the attitude of the military, the top generals. But Mubarak was clinging to the power to the end. I'll tell you a secret. On the Thursday, I wrote an article with the title The Fall of Mubarak. On the Thursday. Thursday. And I was waiting to hear his speech.
And then you were disappointed.
Thinking he would resign. Everybody thought that. So I listened to the speech. And I said, you old bastard. He's staying in power. Which is not what the Americans wanted. It's not what the generals wanted. Because the thing would be really out of control. And the Friday, it was out of control. That was really a mass national uprising. And of course, then it was finished. He was forced to resign. Now, what conclusions do we draw? Well, first of all, it's not finished in Egypt. You see, revolution is not a single event. It's a process. People don't understand that. These clever Marxists, they refuse to recognize that it's they don't know what a revolution is. Trotsky explained what a revolution is in the prologue of the history of the Russian Revolution. He says the essential feature of a revolution is the eruption of the masses on the stage of history, where the masses begin to participate actively in politics, yes, and take their destiny into their own hands. And it goes through different stages. You can study the French Revolution, you find it went through stages over several years, from 1789 to 93. That's what, 4 years, approximately. Or 94, yes, 4 or 5 years. And it went through all kinds of stages. The Russian Revolution of 1917 started in February, but it wasn't finished until October. And between February and October, there were all kinds of ups and downs. For example, in July, August, there was actually a counter-revolution, reaction. Lenin had to flee, he had to go to Finland. And that led to another revolutionary movement in September, culminating in October. The Spanish Revolution started, you could say, in 1931. The really Spanish speaking, it started in 1930 with the student demonstration. It only finished in May of 1937. 7 years. And in that period, there were periods of great advance, like April 1931, with the fall of the monarchy. But then you also had the Bienio Negro, the two black years, 1934 to 1936, period of ferocious reaction. But that led directly to the Popular Front and then civil war. That's what a revolution is. And in the case of Egypt, Tunisia, and all the other countries, we can say that the revolution has started, but it's certainly not finished. Now, I think I've dealt with the movement in Egypt and in Tunisia. And I'll just make one general point. I said this is a fundamental turning point. That's true in many senses. I'll just give you one sense. Not long ago, if you'd have said, in any country that is represented, talk about revolution, and people will say, oh, yes, you're like a man from Mars or a woman from Mars. Yeah, in general, if you just talk about revolution, it doesn't make sense. Now it's entirely different. In America also, people are talking about this. They can see it on the they can see what a revolution is. They can see that revolution is possible. This is very dangerous for the ruling class. They thought they were very clever 20 years ago when you had the movements in Eastern Europe. They thought they were very clever. They like that. Now they're not so sure. Many young people are thinking about revolution. Now the movement is continuing. You see in Libya now. There are differences in all these countries. In the case of Libya, Gaddafi, I think he's clinically insane. The man, I've always thought he's clinically insane. I'm not joking. He's clinically insane. It goes with the job, yes, but in his case, it's an extreme case. He's as mad as a hatter. And he doesn't care if the whole country goes down. Apparently now he's using the Air Force and the Navy to bombard. This is crazy. But he's lost control of Benghazi. The revolution is in control of Benghazi, which is the second biggest city. That's right. And I don't see how a regime like that can last. I don't see. Except I think he's got a mercenary army, mainly of foreigners, I would think. That's the reason. But Gaddafi can end up the same way as Ceausescu, you know. Or like Mussolini dangling from a petrol pump, you know. Upside down. Yeah, but you see, this really is, you can see the flames of revolution are spreading uncontrollably now. In Bahrain is a small state. It's a little island. It's hardly a dot on the map. And you wouldn't think that you could have a revolution in Bahrain. There is a revolution in Bahrain. And another element that's very important in all these demonstrations in all these countries, including Bahrain, which shows it's a revolution, is the presence of the women. Many of them without veils, by the way. Many of them without veils, which is an act of defiance itself. But even more significant is the ones who actually turn up wearing the burqa, yes. Even the burqa, yes. Even burqas, I've seen women with burqas. In Egypt, I've seen them. This is when the women are roused, and by God, you could see that they're militant. They're prepared to die. Oh, yeah. Women have led every revolution in history. Do you know that? They led the French Revolution. They led the Russian Revolution. And in Bahrain, again, they tried the violence. They tried to use, and their foreign troops, obviously Pakistanis probably, Masjid showed the same courage, the same determination. And she said, look, shoot her, Sharam, shoot me. I'm not afraid. And they had to withdraw the troops. Now they've occupied Pearl Square.
No,
they've left again, have they?
The people have occupied. Sorry, I thought you meant the military.
No, the people have occupied.
Yes.
And the masses are on the streets, and they will not be able to put that down. They won't be able to put it down.
100,000 on the square last night.
According to Nicholas, there were 100,000 on the square last night. What's the population of Bahrain? I don't know.
Half a million.
It's one million, actually. Population is 1 million. If there's 100,000 people in the square, work it out. And they're talking about the general strike. Now, what is important about Bahrain is its geographical location. By the way, it's the base of the 5th Fleet. The American 5th Fleet is based in Bahrain. That's the most important American fleet in the whole area. And they can't do anything about it. What can they do? But the importance about Bahrain is that it's next to Iran. It's opposite Iran. And it's right next door to Saudi Arabia. I won't say much about Iran. I'm hoping that Comrade Hamid will speak. But you see, the revolution, although Iran is not part of the Arab world, but it's definitely affected by this. And the cracks are opening up in the regime. They're increasingly serious, to the extent that last week the commanders of the Revolutionary Guard, one of the pillars of the regime, sent a letter to their commanding officer. Say, look, don't ask us to fire on the people, because we're not prepared to do it. We consider it to be against the principles of Shiite Islam to fire on the people. And they even warned the besieged. They said, look, to the commanding officer, tell the besieged not to, when they come to the next demonstration, leave their truncheons in the house. They said that. Which opens up the possibility of a conflict between the Revolutionary Guard and the besieged. That's very serious. And last but least, the Saudi Arabia. Last but not least, is Saudi Arabia. I've said years ago that the Saudi regime is hanging by a thread. You might say, oh, they've got plenty of oil, they're all right. Yes, but the figures I've seen is that for the last 20 years at least, the living standards of the masses in Saudi Arabia has been falling. The problem is this, you see. If you have a dictatorial or a totalitarian regime, there's no reformist parties, there's no reformist trade unions. It's like a pressure cooker without a safety valve. And therefore, that will erupt without any warning. There'll be no warning. It'll explode without warning. And if they don't have a reformist party and reformist trade unions, it's like Egypt. It's like going downhill with a car with no brakes. And last week, there was a very significant development. Friday, I think. The Mufti was the head of the Wahhab clergy, the Wahhabi Islam. The Mufti of Saudi Arabia warned the regime. He warned the royal family. You better make concessions immediately. You must raise the standards of the masses. Or what happened in Tunisia and Egypt is going to happen in Saudi Arabia. And he drew attention to the corruption of the regime, of the royal family. He says, you are spending billions. And people are living in poverty. Now, this is absolutely without precedent. It's the House of Saud, the royal house, royal family, is corrupt as hell. All these Islamic, yes, Allahu Akbar, Mecca, the Prophet, Islam, purity. And they're drunks, drug addicts, thieves.
Playboys.
They spend their time in brothels, in Western capitals, of course. One of these princes was arrested in London about a month ago. I was surprised that he was arrested because they never do arrest these gangsters. Because he'd murdered one of his servants. This is typical. I think he must have been a Filipino. I don't know. Not a Saudi. No, I know that. That's what I'm saying. I don't know where he was from. That's what I'm saying. And he was he murdered this guy, engaged in homosexual acts and tortured, and the man died. No, he tortured this man. Never mind about killing him. He tortured him. And he died. And he was sentenced. I don't know whether he probably won't be sent to jail, of course. How can we send a Saudi Arabia, for instance? This is the scum that exists in the royal family. Scum, absolutely the scum of the earth. And the reason they survived so long is because they got to deal with the Wahhabis, with the Islamic fanatics. You don't criticize us. No, you don't criticize us. And we leave you to run the religious affairs of Saudi Arabia and outside of Saudi Arabia. That's why this gangster Bin Laden, he's from a wealthy Saudi family. Typical bastard, gangster. So if the Mufti comes out and criticizes publicly the royal house, this is serious. They must be trembling in their royal shoes. By the way, they're split and in crisis. The royal family's in crisis over succession. Which one of the gangsters is going to take over? Because the king is old and sick and syphilitic, probably. So Arabia Saudi Arabia will go like that. Now, in the case of Saudi Arabia and, by the way, Yemen is very high up on the list. Now, in the case of Saudi Arabia and Libya, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what kind of regime would emerge. It's a question mark that I've got. There can be all kinds of developments. But one thing is clear, that the whole thing now is in a boiling cauldron. Not one of these regimes is going to survive. Now, I've run out of time, but just one important PS. First of all that is occurring is a complete and absolute vindication of the tendency of this, of the perspectives of this tendency going back for decades. And it will have a profound effect on the Palestinian question and Israel. The Israelis are terrified, but they're also impotent. Netanyahu couldn't even make a pronouncement about it. He had to keep his mouth shut. Anything he said would pour petrol on the flames. But the problem is this. Look, Hamas, which has got a ferocious dictatorship, suppressed an anti-Mubarak demonstration. They're terrified of what is happening in Egypt. And they've opened up a Facebook. You see, I must get on Facebook. They've opened up a Facebook in Gaza for the overthrow, calling for an intifada against Hamas. So Hamas is in trouble. But the PLO is in bigger trouble. We must thank our friends from WikiLeaks for that. It's emerged that this gangster Abbas has completely betrayed the cause of the Palestinians, has done a deal with Israel. By the way, the first result of this is that the so-called peace progress is finished. It was finished before, actually. Where they were Netanyahu was doing what he wanted. It emerged from WikiLeaks that Abbas had made all the concessions on everything, the right of return, Jerusalem, everything. Take it. And Netanyahu said no, and continues to build the settlements. And even last week in the United Nations, the Americans vetoed a condemnation of Israel in the settlements. That will make them popular. Vetaron una condena de Israel sobre cuestión de los asentamientos. Eso les hará muy popular. I've forgotten what I was saying. No? Yes, as a matter of fact, there was a cartoon in The Economist. I can't resist it. I can't resist it, yeah. There was the negotiations between the Americans, Netanyahu, and the Israeli, three of them. Netanyahu is an Israeli. Netanyahu, the Americans, and the Palestinians. Might have to explain this. Yes. And the American says to Netanyahu, or to the Israeli, says, take a seat. So the Israeli picks up the seat and walks out of the room. And the American is looking aghast at the Palestinian with his mouth open. And the Israeli comes back into the room. And he says, is anyone using this table? that's the peace talks. But it's been discredited in public now. It even emerged that the PLO, that the Israelis informed the PLO that they were going to attack Gaza. Yes. This is known. And there's a ferment of rage among the Palestinians. There's a ferment. The leaders are discredited. All the idea of the peace talks is discredited. And therefore the idea will be forming in the minds of many Palestinians, both in the West Bank and in Gaza, we need another intifada. And the Economist made a comment, interesting comment. Yes. In the event of an intifada, it is not clear whether the Palestinian Authority will be able to put fire on the demonstrators, or the Israeli army. It can have a big effect inside Israel, where, by the way, they're talking about a general strike in Israel. So I will finish for lack of time. But you see what I meant at the beginning, that this is a fundamental turn in world history.